I'm not a geologist, contrary to the announcement. I would make that very clear. I've been a rock hound much of my life because my father, who was a teacher, school administrator, and later on second career Lutheran pastor, following a long line of Lutheran pastors and so on, got into rocks when his mother gave him an interesting, said, look at this rock. He got interested in it and was collecting or studying rocks as a hobby most of his life. So he was a rock hound and I was a pebble pup, being an only child. I inherited tons of rocks. I have done a selective geological museum from those, the Fiedler Memorial Museum at Texas Lutheran University, where I am, from which I am retired. I did teach a little intro to geology, a one semester course, but we do not have a geology department. I'm primarily a geographer, science educator, and amateur theologian, if you wish, because I've preached and I've done a lot of Bible studies and things of that nature, so that this is a very important part of my life. But this is not to be about me particularly at all. The idea, consider the rocks, really comes out of the Psalms in a way. Now, it doesn't come through in this translation, but you know in Psalm 8, when I consider your heavens, look at the work of your hands, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars that you've established, what are human beings that you're mindful of them, mortals that you care for them? It's one of the many Psalms of praise. To consider means to look at something and to study it. And I can substitute rocks in there and have the same feeling. Last week I did something on what we call the looking at creation spirituality, recognizing that we do not worship rocks, we do not worship trees or mountains, but that these things can speak to us of the majesty of God, and that we are all part, we as living beings, we and all other living beings, and the whole creation are together as a unity in which God's transcendence may work. So it's in that spirit, and in a really a sense of reverence, that I look at rocks and the rocks around as a way of moving me to worship. I don't worship the rocks, but I am moved by them to worship. I'll tell you that later. There are all kinds of references in Hebrew scriptures to rocks. And the obvious reason for that is that it's pretty dry country, the area, Israel, Jordan, that whole region, as everybody knows. It's desert country. It's very, very dry. So you don't have trees all over the place that are fuzzing over the rocks. So you see the rocks out there when you go to Israel, Jordan. How many of you have been over there? Yeah, so you know that it's a dry. Now, the Israelis have planted a lot of trees.
I planted them.
But there are not a lot of rocks. The rocks are sticking out. And therefore, the early psalmist, for example, who would be out there maybe with sheep or whatever, they were seeing rocks. And they use these analogies. Somebody who has one of those Bibles, would you read Psalm 18, verse 31 for us, please? And somebody else, 18:31, who's doing that? Would you? All right. And then we'll do 31, 1, 2, 3, and then 61, verse 2. I think three people have Bibles. All right. What do we have? All out from the Psalms. Psalm 18, verse 31.
In you, O Lord, I seek refuge. Do not let me ever be put to shame. In your righteousness, deliver me. Incline your ear to me. Rescue me speedily. Be a rock of refuge for me, a strong fortress to save me. You are indeed my rock and my fortress. For your name's sake, lead me and guide me.
Thank you. That was Psalm, was that 31? Yeah, that was Psalm 31, verses 1 through 3. All right, where is the hiding place? Where is strength? And you see, how do you picture God? Well, a rock of refuge. There are all kinds of references. Who has Psalm 18, verse 31? Yes, please.
For who is God except the Lord? And who is a rock beside our God?
Yeah. Solidity. Something, someone, a presence you can count on. The idea of solidity, of something supporting us. And just one more, because this doesn't exhaust it. Psalm 61, verse 2, who has that? Who's the other person who had the Bible?
Here.
Oh, thank you. Come on, there's plenty of room over here. Come on.
You said Psalm 61?
61, verse 2.
From the end of the earth I call to you, and my heart is faint. Lead me to the rock that is higher than I.
Yeah. Well, that's just a fragment. It's taken out of context. Come on, there's some more room over here. Well, there's more room. And we could find others, but the idea that when we look at Hebrew scriptures and people trying to say something about that inspires them, and what kind of language do they use, very often it's rock language. All right, now a lot of people don't pay any attention to rocks because, you know, they're just there. This is my little Snoopy cartoon. I used this last week. I like this. I'll tell you about it, and then I'll pass it around. This is a Peanuts cartoon. Here is a little dog walking along, and the little dog says, I think it's a sin to be bored. Frame two, just look at the world around you. Come on in. Just think of all the wonderful things out there for us to see. Then he comes to this big rock. Yeah, if that rock wasn't in the way. And that is the way that some people do look at rocks. Well, with the idea that I see forms of worship and stretching my concept of God and so on and so forth in the landscape around, even though I'm not a geologist or anything like that, we're looking at really consider the rocks and the roadsides and stories and layers tonight. Tomorrow we do volcanoes, Pompeii possibilities. I just want to say that for many states, there is a popular geology guide where if you're traveling certain highways, they'll tell you, they'll explain the rocks along the way. Mm-hmm. I've borrowed this one from the bookstore, Roadside Geology of Washington. But I know there are a number of other states that have the roadside guides. And each, of course, is done by different people who know that particular region. For Texas, there have been a second edition with a different author. And so, anybody familiar that your state has a roadside guide? It may be, I know, Wyoming, Colorado, California. It's a press in Montana, so they've done more of the western states. But there are ways in which you can learn about what's around you. Well, let's look at layers with the introduction. Oh yeah, one more little statement here. You know Ansel Adams, the photographer, the wonderful, who deceased now, and probably his classic picture, of course, in black and white, was that Yosemite by Moonlight? Mm-hmm. You recall that? And he said about that, the way he did it, to sanctify a religious idea and to inquire of my own soul just what the primeval scene really signifies. In the last analysis, Half Dome, you know, Yosemite, the picture he took, that one, is just a piece of rock. But the facts molded into transcendent emotional and spiritual experiences. Mm-hmm. So that for this photographer who was taking pictures of Half Dome in Yosemite, it became a spiritual experience. And that's what we're saying that rock study has done for me, but it may not do that for you. But anyway, let's, I'm going to have to turn on the slide projector back here. It's ready to go. I just need to turn it off. Someone know how to do that? And we'll turn off the left-hand light, please. Just the left-hand switch. The others will be fine. See it all the way over. All the way over to the, there we go. Thank you very much. Since Mark, and the left hand, far to the left, will turn off this light. I think, yeah, thank you. Since Mark and his marvelous Bible study this morning was talking about Ruth of the Moabitess, I just happened to have a slide of Moab. It illustrates that. And as you see, it's pretty dry country, and the rocks are sticking out there. This is on the Jordanian side, Jordan. And if you will look carefully, what do you see?
Layers.
Layers, right. In fact, in much of Israel, it's mostly layered rock. Not all places, but mostly. And by the way, a lot of it looks very much like the Texas Hill Country. I teach Owner Hostel for Presbyterian Assembly Mole Ranch, and we point that out, that when you see the limestone layers in the Texas Hill Country, you can be looking at Israel, except that the vegetation is different. All right, and I happen to have one more of Israel. This is above the Dead Sea. Again, what do you see?
Layers.
All right. So layers of rock are one way in which we encounter rock. And we usually think of them as being sedimentary, kind of. And we make some assumptions that about the geologists make some assumptions. Just sort of like you think of layer cakes. Well, I don't know how many people bake layer cakes anymore, but some of you remember layer cakes? Multiple layer cakes? Yeah. Which layer goes on first?
Bottom one.
Unless you do an upside down. I mean, that could be an accident. But ordinarily, you assume that the ones that are on top got there some way or the other after some of these down below. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
The geologists have fancy names for everything. They call it the principle of superposition, but that the younger ones normally would be atop. Now, you can drop the whole layer cake, and that story can be mixed up, but that's another story, not for today. All right, layered rocks. Well, when you came into Holden Village, many of you came along this road or a road like that. And I marvel each time I do that, because you are also seeing layers, right? Mm-hmm. And these layers are very distinct in some places, where there is talus, broken rock sort of at the base, but layers. And what are those layers? That's the outpouring of lava, fissure eruption, the basalts of the Columbia Plateau, Washington, Oregon, Idaho primarily, thousands of feet thick in places, outpourings of heavy, dense lava, which you see very clearly. The dry falls of the Columbia, for example, where there used to be great waterfalls over that when the great ice dam broke after the last ice age, but that's another story too. We can't do all those stories. But the layers are just very, very clear. And for the lava, anything like that, it's fairly reasonable that the top ones would have been more recent than the others. Now, how long does it take? Depends on conditions, but we see layered rocks also here in the Columbia Plateau. Outside Spokane, any of you come in that way? There are some interesting things that have happened to these layers. Some of them have fractured vertical joints and so on, that's basalt. When the layers cooled, a lot of them did that kind of thing. They fracture like this. But the layers run this way, horizontally, but as they cooled, they fractured vertically. So you can get fooled by layers unless you look at them very carefully. The layers go horizontally, but the fracturing is vertical. Basalt, columnar basalt, and so on, that you can see in the Northwest, a lot of it around here. However, we're really not talking about layers made by volcanoes today, except that volcanic action can make layers. Exhibit A in the United States is the Columbia Plateau, right around where we are, close by. Now, this I took, I think last time I was here, 2 years ago, up on the tailings. And surely the tailings are a real concern. Those of you who walk with me today, we discussed just a little bit, I mean, how they used to blow. They've been there quite a while, you know, like, you see, 37, 47, 67, you know, 30, 40 years, a lot of this. And they dump stuff. You can imagine big trucks going out there, dumping all this stuff. And when I felt these, they had really turned to rock. In other words, in the 30, 40 years, whenever this was dumped here, these layers of stuff hauled there had consolidated. rain, snow melt in there, the minerals sort of pulling things together. That is a way of making rock from sediments. In this case, it's a fairly recent process because we know the history of what happened here. But it illustrates how rocks can be formed from other broken up stuff, which this is, with the minerals sort of acting to sort of bind them together. And so there's a little bit of layered, and I call it sedimentary rock right here. Now, this is another familiar experience. I always wear a hat when I'm out someplace, and sometimes I use my hat for scale. Okay. You've seen that? Where would you see something like that? Yeah, creek bed. Okay, the creek, a muddy creek or something overflows, a good rainstorm or something. All right, the creek bed dries, mud cracks in here, and so the mud gets pretty hard. Did you ever pick up a piece of hard mud? It gets pretty hard after a while. So you can see it's not yet rock, but it is hardened. And what's interesting is you sometimes have those cracks filling in, and I have some good specimens of where you have hard mud cracks where other stuff is filled in. And so that idea, here's another one. You can see that in many places. It's a beginning stage of one kind of sedimentary rock where you have just it's mud, it's going to be kind of shale, which is just sort of hardened mud, and other things can happen to it later. So you can see some of the beginnings in the past. This is close up. It's on the Rio Grande and Big Bend National Park. But this is different levels of where the river had flooded. And you see, sometimes it was a bigger flood so that it carried out bigger rocks. And sometimes it was not such a big flood, and so there weren't any really bigger rocks moved, and not huge rocks ever, but little sediments. And so you see layer after layer from different floods. And sometimes there was a pretty strong current. And here there was a lot of mud deposited. And in the background are cliffs also, which are much, much older, but showing deposits. So sedimentary rocks, sediment. Water is the chief agent that deposits sediments, pieces of sediment. This again is along the Rio Grande. You see layers, but you also see things that look vertical, like you saw on the plateau, Columbia Plateau, where you have cracks and things like that. So this is basically limestone material. Now, what we get into here, though, we see it along the river, but in this stuff are also marine fossils. So that we don't just have rivers, but we have indications of dramatic changes of climate. Layered rocks. This is sort of a shale, pretty hard rock. They find fish fossils in this. Fossil fish. Look at the foreground. What's your climate? Mm-hmm. Pretty dry. This is in Wyoming. See? What were fish doing swimming around in Wyoming here? See, if you find your fossils there, they used to be there, fossil fish. A lot of wonderful fossil fish that you find in museums and you can buy in some rock shops come from Wyoming. They're not terribly old. They're Eocene age, if you're interested in ages. But so that rocks, layered rocks, can tell us how climates have changed in places, have changed drastically. This is common roadside in Texas, the limestone. That's because we have an awful lot of this kind of stuff. And I see I didn't bring most of my good limestone pictures, but we're going elsewhere, where you can see something about thick and thin. And this, again, is a kind of landscape that has marine fossils in it, seashells. A lot of it's just loaded with seashells. A little crinoid, a little sea urchins, things like that. It's about 200 miles from the coast. So obviously something has changed in the past. This is in Arizona, sort of dry country. And this is limestone again, which is, we say, is marine origin because of the fossils, the nature. Limestone is made mainly of calcium carbonate, which is your stuff in chalk, in seashells and things like that. Which is a pretty good clue that things were a lot different here at one time in Arizona. And there's another place where you have limestone with the sometimes joints or cracks. Limestone usually is chalky looking. Sometimes it is, this is back on the Rio Grande, Big Bend, layers and layers of it, very chalky. Some places it's fine grained, thick grained, thick bedded. A lot of layers here that go way up. Those are my students' general term. And sometimes it's, if you're on the river, it's some of the layers are sort of bent and slumped, just like you drop the layer cake or it sags. You ever have a cake sagged on you in the middle? I mean, those of us who try to bake, you know, sometimes they sag or they go to one side. Rocks can do that. So that raises some questions here. Yeah. And here again, this is sort of a shaley limestone. Again, I think marine deposits. This is way out in West Texas. Miles and miles and miles from the ocean, like 500 miles away from any ocean right now. Very, very dry country. So layers are suggesting stories. Red. All right, we saw red, we see red in the tailings here. We said usually when you see red, rusty colors, more rusty, it's a pretty good clue that there's some iron in there. So when you see very red rocks, very often that's a clue there's a lot of iron and that the climate was pretty dry and maybe fairly warm, so there's a high rate of oxidation, of rusting, you might say almost. So if you think of your Arizona, Utah, your wonderful colors out there, a lot of that is associated with climates in the past, like this area. The layers are so clear here. This is sandstone. Layers and layers of sandstone. And you see they're wearing. I mean, they're weathering there. And then the wind is blowing in here. Some of those trees might be buried, just like the tailings used to be, the fine stuff used to blow and try to cover stuff. But the idea of change, rocks that are there break up, make new rocks eventually, maybe. Sandstone, where did the sand come from? Always raises good questions. Around Sedona, Arizona. Some of you have been there, very, very scenic. You've got the red rocks, you've got some white layers in there. Layered rocks, horizontal layered rocks are through much of the west and the southwest. Now, if you get, out east, New England and so on, that's a whole other story. But as far as layered rocks in the middle of the country and the interior west is where that's just typical western movie scenery, isn't it? Mm-hmm. I mean, those kind of layers kind of thing. Bryce Canyon, where you have the effect that is near Sharks, where you have old slide, where you have erosion cutting into these sandstone layers and so on. A lot of our national park scenery. That's back to Sedona, I should have done a little good picture. All right, and so your monument country, like in Utah, that idea, that's very massive stuff. But if you see the layers, lower layers, the layers are not all the same, right? But it suggests awfully long time to pile up that much stuff, right? I mean, you think about it, need a human being on there for scale, but that's pretty high stuff in there. So the idea of layering. Now, sometimes the layers, this is on the Missouri River, followed the trail of Lewis and Clark one time and we canoed the wild and scenic river in Missouri. White sandstone cliffs way up there and layers of sandstone in there along the river. Where did all the sandstone come from? How long did it take to lay it down? You always come up with more questions than you have answers for. Mm-hmm. Ah, we have people from Wisconsin here, right? Mm-hmm. Who are Wisconsin people? Anybody? Yeah, you recognize where this is?
Wisconsin.
Yes, it's in the Dells of Wisconsin, yeah. And there's some interesting stuff. It's basically sandstone, but what do you notice about the layers? Yeah, they're sort of crooked. They say they're cross-bedded. Now, that can happen with water, where the stream sort of moves one direction, then sort of another, but streams usually go down a certain way, or it may be wind deposit, because the winds don't always blow in the same way. So sometimes these are wind-deposited structures. This is one of the classic ones at Zion National Park. I was there again this summer with my family. I just put this in an old picture. You can get that. It's a classic textbook example of cross-bedding, where you've got layers, sedimentary, but they're at an angle, something blue, or washed one way, and then another way, or something. I took that one, this one this summer. And there you've got layers on top, right? And then some of them go this way, and look at that. Yeah. There's some mighty powerful stories there. And geologists try to read those stories and try to make some sense of them. And it's apparent that this didn't happen in one fell swoop, right? That something happened first, maybe long periods of time, and then something else, and then something else. And so we're seeing a story of long periods of time. All right, when we get to layered rocks, some of them are pretty significant for us economically. We are going out east here. This is West Virginia. What do you see here?
Coal.
It's a layer of coal, sure. And I'm sure most of you know that coal is really a kind of a sedimentary rock. What's coal made from?
Trees.
All right. Organic material, plant material. Because we find beautiful fossils of leaves and stuff. Leaves and sometimes bugs, but normally leaves and plants and bark and things like that, and coal in some coal mines. Which tells us that there were some living things here. Now there's a layer at the bottom that's pretty thin little layers. It's sort of shaley, muddy kind of thing. And then this organic material. Well, if you have the coal, what did you have to have there before?
Vegetation,
precisely. Vegetation. So you have a time when there was vegetation growing there, which died, was compressed somewhere or the other, and then on top of this is limestone. Now, you see enough of it, you can tell, but I mean, this is limestone, which has a lot of water deposits on top of that. There's something else on top, way up there, which suggests a pretty long period of time in there, someplace along the line. Here's a closer view of some of that. You can see the layers of coal. Sometimes there's plants die, vegetation, mud washes in, covers a layer. More plants grow, year after year, millennia getting in here almost. So there's a lot of earth story in those layers. And I think there's a fossil up there in that other white layer, limestone layer. And so you don't have to know the answers to be able to marvel at it. In other words, I can see something like this and I can read up on what the geologists have figured out about it. But even if I don't know all the answers, I can say, wow, my God, how great thou art. There's a lot of time and different things represented there that are beyond my comprehension. This is lignite. What's that?
Coal.
That's a soft coal kind of, and that's actually in a pit about 40, 50 miles of south of Seguin, Texas, where I live, where we certainly didn't have any, we don't have any swampy areas right now around there. we need rain. Lignite coal, and that's in a whole stratum of layer of stuff. But there must have been a time when there were swampy areas there, because that's the kind of stuff that makes this lignite coal. And this is in the same pit where the lignite is. There's also a layer in there of volcanic ash, that is rich in uranium. And for a while we had uranium processing mine south of us from volcanic ash that blew in and made some layers in there. There was enough in there to get what they call yellow cake uranium. And then other stuff was deposited on top of it. There are stories in it. By the way, that had some real interesting environmental concerns in terms of the processing. That's another story, too, because it was not all good for the environment. It's closed now, but layers. And so this is an early picture out of Gillette, Wyoming. Now, that was early in the development of some of the Western coal out here. Eastern coal is fairly acidic in places, and a lot of it is a little hard to get into, kind of into the mines, you know. Here, out in Wyoming, in this dry area, was coal. When this was wet, swampy vegetation, and you just had to strip mine it out of the ground. Now, this picture was taken at least 25, 30 years ago. And I have heard that this whole area has been, you know, really dug into and got some problems with it, environmental problems, because this is low sulfur coal, but it's layers. And when the layers are this close to the ground, to the surface, well, people went for it when they discovered it. So in our layered rocks, some of them surely have some economic significance for people. All right, another thing about layered rocks that you can look at just when you're someplace, I think we're back in West Virginia right here. Notice the bottom layer. Well, it's sort of thick, right? Then you see some little teensy layers in the middle. See them? So we talk about thick-bedded and thin-bedded. And the geologist would say, all right, this is a time when there was maybe water here standing a long, long time. So you have sediment, and we're talking about ocean here, deposit things falling from the shells of little creatures, just depositing the lime, depositing out of the water, building up. And then you've got a change. You've got a time when you have ebb and flow, because you've got a thin layer, another thin layer, not a continuous kind of thing. So when you see something like this, you say, hey, how come that's thick and how come those are the tiny layers? And if you don't know the answer, just sort of marvel at them. New York State, Ossable Chasm, layers. Mm-hmm. Old limestone rock, and the river's cutting through. And sometimes some things happen to rocks where the layers don't exactly match. So we've got fault lines and cracks, and that's another story that we'll take up later this week. But a lot of scenery has layered rocks in it, which I hope will arouse questions. This is my city hall in Seguin, Texas, where they have used some local materials. I mean, not from right there, but from within 50 miles at the most, maybe less. And that whole layer of natural rock is full of what?
Shells,
seashells. And again, the rock comes from 150 miles at least away from the coast. So there's one thing that seems to be very clear when we look at rocks inland, is that climates have changed, where maybe once it was pretty wet, now it's dry, or vice versa. And also the relationship of sea and land has changed, so that there have been seas not once, but many times over the landscape. That is really the story of my part of the country, of seas covering the land, seas inland, where there are now no seas. We have any Minnesota people? Yeah. This is up on the, oh, what is that river? This is a very, very old sandstone, sandy sandstone. This was a geologist from the University of Minnesota. The summer I was taking a course at the University of Minnesota. What is that river that
Saint
goes
Croix.
Up? What?
Saint
Croix. Saint Croix. Yeah, it's on the Saint Croix River. Thank you. And what he's picking out here is pieces of trilobites. Mm-hmm. You know what trilobites are?
Yeah.
You know, the little prehistoric, pretty old little critters kind of thing. Extinct. Little tiny little trilobites. They're in Minnesota. They were sea creatures. Minnesota's a long way from the ocean. Yeah. We didn't find any perfect ones. We just found parts of them, the trilobites in Minnesota. Okay. Tell us something.
Okay.
My lens cap for scale here, that is a fossil coral. It's in Gilha in Mexico, but it's fairly young, but it shows that the coral gets into rocks. And this just had some really nice pieces of fossil coral like this, showing that that was making up of a lot of the limestone rocks. Okay, this was really pretty close to the coast. So, you know, no big deal there. It's not that far from the coast, and you can see seas. But in my home county in Texas, which is a good 180 miles from the coast, we also find fossil coral. Coral grows in warm tropical seas. Now, it's still hot in Texas, but it's not that tropical for coral to grow. So, fossil coral in the hills of my home county, which again is a story that the rocks are telling us. Or out here, you know, tree stumps, petrified wood and things like that in an old lake bed, kind of this is a Florissant, Colorado, a great fossil site. You saw we have a lot of sedimentary rocks. This is in Oklahoma where you find all kinds of interesting seashells. White Mound, Oklahoma, famous fossil hunting site. Seashells and other creatures that are now, some of them no longer with us, kind of extinct. And let me get to my own story. Just 7 miles south of the campus, Texas Lutheran University, with which I've been associated for more than 40 years and still live a block and a half and keep my finger in things, we have gravel pits. And the gravel is sort of layered kind of gravel. In these gravel pits, they were digging out gravel for roads and stuff. I mean, just as. And in the process, found some interesting things sticking out of the gravel. Like, see some bones? So the folks who are running the backhoes decided they better quit before they damage something. And so they carefully dug out some things, and that is it's a big tooth of a mastodon, which is a prehistoric elephant. And I have that tooth. And some other things from the gravel pit. And we had some students working on it. So here, in these sedimentary layers, we found pieces, not the whole thing, but pieces of the extinct elephant. That's part of the thigh bone. And a student who is now has a master's in geology working, although we just had one geology course. I mean, but one of my students who went on in geology. And so we have pieces of it in the museum. But fossils are usually associated with layered rocks, is the point. Mostly sedimentary rocks. Now that lava, the Columbia Plateau, has a few places where there are fossils. Ginkgo petrified forest, you know where that is?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, now there are some leaves and things that are preserved there. There are fossils occasionally, but usually the lava is too hot to do much in preserving fossils. So most of our fossil finds are going to be in these layered sedimentary rocks, limestone, sandstone, and shale. And this is just sort of gravel kind of thing. Well, this is another thing close by
it just looks like little water things, you know, little holes of water, but this is on limestone where a person was scraping off surface layers and trying to maybe pour some slabs from mobile homes near a lake. And they realized that those were not just holes, but they seemed to be something else. They're very nice three-toed footprints. Mm-hmm. And I did not bring my good pictures of them, I see. They don't show up as well as these. And immediately, of course, dinosaur footprints. We've got dinosaur footprints all over Texas limestone in different places. Mm-hmm. So this person I lucked out. I mean, he called, you know, the big universities and everybody was out. And somebody said, there's a woman at Texas Lutheran who's interested in this kind of stuff, call her. I was the first person who listened to him. I came out, I said, yeah, you've got footprints, dinosaur footprints. I was lucky to get in touch with Juan Langston, who is premier paleontologist from the University of Texas, who came up and identified the species and stuff. But very clearly, dinosaur footprints. New ones are found all along in creek beds kind of thing. Dinosaurs haven't been around for a while, except in Jurassic Park movies. But their footprints are all over lots of places in Texas and the limestone. Which sort of stretches, you know, concept of time. Now, this guy was trying to get the state to buy this land. No state I know of immediately has money for a state park. So what happened was that there was a group that looked around here and they claimed to see human footprints in here. And they were using it as a creation science theme to prove that people and dinosaurs lived at the same time. Mm-hmm. And so they saw this as a human footprint along with all the other dino footprints. And they were saying, this proves that the Earth can't be as old as the dinosaur people claim. Because their faith, which was so tightly hemmed in by the literal interpretation of days of creation, that for a while they were having their faith strengthened by looking for a footprint. Well, I have spent a lot of time over looking at Texas limestone. You can see anything you want to. I mean, you can imagine a lot of things in there and find rocks shaped like stuff and petrified hearts and so on. But we had a little fact San Antonio Television got into it, and I guess whose side did I take? I said, I believe in the God of the creation, but I don't think I need to limit my concept of God to, you know, putting the Genesis record into the kind of box that ties God to human concept of time. And so, and the dinosaur footprints are still there, but they haven't made much of the human footprints anymore. To me, I think the place that most inspires awe in this country, of course, is the Grand Canyon. This summer I was privileged to be on the North Rim, but one time I did walk down most of the way and rafted it on a geology trip, which was pretty powerful. And when you go down the Grand Canyon, you see a lot of layers tied by limestone at the top. Limestone. Now that's marine limestone. See, you know, Arizona we're talking about. Layers and layers and layers and layers of it. And then you come to sandstone below it. Coconino sandstone. And in the sandstone, there's some little tiny fossil tracks of things. Dry climate, okay. And they have signs if you go down the one of the trails, they'll have these signs. Fossil footprints, primitive breakdown. So you've got a time below when there were clay and muds, freshwater streams, iron compounds, that's why it's red. Up here you've got dry climate. The sandstone is on top of the shale. Okay. Then you come to the Supai. There's an awful lot of that stuff that's red. That's what you see at Sedona. Arid climates, red. Red rocks, dry. And then below that is limestone. Again, lime deposits and quite inland sea, and we've got fossils in there. It's called red wall because all that red stuff in the supai runs down and stains the limestone, so it looks red, but it's basically not red. I have samples of all of these collecting. That's the supai. Little tiny tracks in there of some ancient creature, kind of. And sometimes there was some little contortion of those layers. And then that's still red wall limestone at the bottom. Look how deep that is. And then ecological thing here and political statement. Here's some wonderful springs that come out of the red wall limestone called Basin's Paradise. When John Wesley Powell first went down here in 1869, first time, I mean, they stopped at this wonderful spring because limestone lets water through and so on. And there was a great fresh water coming out here. Had they built another dam here, as was proposed, all of this would have been underwater, which is why I have a very strong bias against big dams that cover up a lot of scenery. But I mean, that's another story also. Anyway, the red wall limestone, I mean, the just the thick layers, that's almost a big cave. Powell and his crew slept in there, but they were worried because they didn't know whether the river would come up and flood. We played frisbee in there. All right. And finally, though, at the very, I mean, that's at the very bottom of the canyon, you get to a different kind of rock, older and older rock. Remember superposition? And not all of this is sedimentary. Some of this is old, old igneous, metamorphic, changed rocks. Look at that. There was a boat kind of thing. And at the bottom of the Grand Canyon, someplace, go back to this other one. At the bottom of the Grand Canyon, one particular point, I have had a memory of a high spiritual experience. One or two of you heard that last week, where I held a piece of this rock, of the Zoroaster granite or the Vishnu schist, which is reputed to be 1.8 billion years old. And I have a picture of myself holding it. Got somebody take it, because I was saying, my God, how great thou art. It was a high moment of worship because it stretched my concept of God through all these tremendous layers and the time that had to be represented there in the rocks of the Grand Canyon. Those are younger rocks, the Mesozoic era and so on that we say of the Grand Canyon. All right, this raises questions, of course, if you're bothered very much about, you know, timing and so on. But I guess I go back to Psalm 90. You know how that goes, right? Psalm 90 says something about, you've been our dwelling place in all generations. Before the mountains were brought forth, or ever you had formed the earth and the world, from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. And someplace in there it says that you are, the days of our life are 70 years or perhaps 80 and so on. The idea of the God of creation who is for 1,000 years in your sight are like yesterday when it is past, a watch in the night. A popular writer in geology has said that the most important concept in geology for the non-geologist is the concept of time. It's a different concept. And to me, my studies of geology have stretched my concept of God. Just like J.B. Phillips said, I think, about astronomy, you know, looking at the heavens, you know, your God is too small if you try to box God in. And to me, that's what my looking at layers of rock have done. I'm going to leave it at that point.